welcome to All Crime, No Cattle. This is episode 6, part 2 of our brand new Lone Star Lunatic series about the Texas truck stop killer.
That's right.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Shay.
And first off, we want to apologize for the delay in putting out this episode. We did have a family emergency that we had to take care of. Everything's better now in regards to that, but we just had to take almost a week off or so to kind of deal with everything in our personal lives. We are hoping to get straight back to our regular recording schedule, which means that we should be putting out another episode on Wednesday, so this is just a couple days away. Fair warning, however, I think I actually might be coming down with a cold. And so we'll have to see if maybe we'll have to actually put that off as well. So sorry, guys, we are trying our best, but we...
You know, life gets in the way sometimes.
Life gets in the way.
It does.
It really does.
Crazy events happen. And
I really hope that this is just a weird sudden allergy attack and it's not that I'm getting sick. But I do feel kind of bad right now. So.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Well, stay tuned for that.
We wanted to start this episode by going ahead and citing some of our sources for these are sources that we used both in part one and in today's episode. So we did a lot of research to compile all of this information together in one sort of storyline format with most articles, books, or documentaries, or whatever information is out there. Each item doesn't detail the full scope of the case, so we had to do a lot of legwork to put all this information together for you guys. So Shay, would you like to talk about our citations?
Yeah, so let's start off with, we found quite a few things on YouTube. They're two really well done, even if they're slightly a little bit dated. They're documentaries on Robert Ben Rhodes that you can find on YouTube, and they're called Investigation Discoveries, Killer Truckers, and the FBI Files Serial Killer Robert Ben Rhodes. They're really good. I'd check them out. They're a little bit old, but they've got good stuff in there. And then, of course, as always, we definitely do our due diligence on pulling up everything we can find on Murderpedia. It's a go-to source for us true crime podcasters. We use pretty much every article under the Robert Ben Rhodes listing, but especially we wanted to mention the Tucson Weekly article, Dead End, by Karen Brandl. That was a really good one. It had a lot of direct quotes from the FBI agents.
Yeah. And finally, we do want to give a shout out to the book Roadside Prey by Alva Bush. This is a book that we ordered, a month ago. We paid extra for expedited shipping. And it has yet to actually arrive. And at this point, we don't know if we're ever going to physically get our hands on this book. But we've heard so much about this book that we really wanted to talk about it because it's supposed to be the go-to source for the full Robert Ben Rhodes story. So what we're going to do is, if we ever get this book in the mail, what we're going to do is we're going to go through it, see if there's any additional information that we haven't presented to you guys in these two episodes. And we might do like a mini episode on it with information just from that book. So, you know, look for that if that's something that we end up doing.
Yeah, I know we already got a refund for it, but it might show up.
It might show up. It might also be in Timbuktu. Who knows? Thanks, Amazon. You were really helpful on all that. To recap part one of this series, last week we talked about Robert Ben Rhodes, the long-haul trucker. He had been charged with a kidnapping and sexual assault of Katie Ford in the year 1990. He was found to have a sort of torture dungeon in the sleeping compartment of his truck where he had assaulted and tortured her. Because of his cavalier attitude, his high level of depravity, and his sophisticated rape and torture kit, investigators really suspected that Rhodes was probably the perpetrator of other sexual assaults and even murder. After all, Rhodes had also been investigated previously on the kidnapping and sexual assault of the woman Nicole Tettle, who was able to escape but was too frightened to press charges against him. So when we left off last week, FBI investigators had completed a search and seizure of Rhodes' Houston apartment, where they found violent pornography, bondage and torture gear, and most alarmingly, photos of possible additional victims. FBI agent Bob Lee knew that the women in these photographs were victims of Robert Ben Rhodes' sexual depravity, and they were possibly even dead. But legally, investigators really had no way of proving that the women weren't engaged in consensual acts between adults. And because of this, Lee and his team weren't able to broadcast the pictures to the media because they could be unwittingly violating the women's rights to privacy. So they had all of these pictures, but they really didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah.
The only option they had was to wait and see if they could match the women in the photographs to other rape or murder victims as they sort of fell into their lap.
Yeah, I'd also like to say about last week is, you know, last week was crazy. But if you thought that was crazy, like we were getting to, this week gets even more brutal and more ridiculous. So are you ready to jump and dive into it?
Yeah, I am.
All right, well, off we go.
So February 5th, this is the same day that Nicole Tuttle escaped her attacker near Houston. Regina Walters and Ricky Lee Jones are 15 miles away in Pasadena, Texas, thumbing for rides. Regina was a 14-year-old girl who had last been seen in her mother's apartment in Pasadena, Texas. Her young life had been filled with early struggles. Her older sister had committed suicide. Her older brother had regular brushes with the law. Her parents were divorced, and although she spent most of her time with her father in Houston, she had been visiting her mother in Pasadena, Texas. Regina's mother, Carolyn Walters, was a single mom who worked really long hours, and she really struggled to parent Regina, who was a bit of a wild child who had a history of running away and staying out late. On the night of February the 3rd, Regina's mother, Carolyn, came home from work and was surprised to find Regina missing. She wasn't there. There weren't any notes or other signs of Regina being home recently, and when she checked her answering machine, there were no messages left from Regina. A few nights before this, Carolyn and Regina had gotten into a bit of a fight. It was about 9:30 p.m. one night, and Regina, remember, 14-year-old Regina, wanted to go out and hang out with her friends. Her mom argued against this, didn't think it was a good idea, but Regina assured her that she would be home later that night. She would be right back. So after arguing back and forth a little bit, Carolyn let her daughter go out and told her to call if she stayed out late that night. This was, unfortunately, the last time that Carolyn saw her daughter. So again, Regina had a history of running away, but she would always return on her own, maybe the next night or a couple nights after. Carolyn knew this time was different, though. What Carolyn didn't know is that Regina had decided to run away with 18-year-old Ricky Lee Jones, who was a neighbor who lived in the apartment complex nearby. They had only known each other for a few days, because remember, Regina had just been visiting her mother, so they had just met, and they decided to run away to Mexico together, where Ricky had family residing somewhere in Mexico. Ricky Lee Jones had minor brushes with the law, but he was basically described as a kid who was pretty quiet, pretty nice guy. He'd also had a bit of a tough life. He and his siblings had been taken away from their family by CPS when they were younger. When Carolyn arrived this night at her apartment and she realized that Regina was still gone, she first started by contacting Regina's friends as well as her father back in Houston, and she realized that no one had heard from her. Carolyn then starts posting missing person flyers all around town, but she gets no immediate response from the public to provide information about where her missing child is. After about two nights, since Regina goes missing, and with getting no additional contact from Regina, Carolyn then reports Regina missing to the Pasadena Police Department. She gave a description of Regina as a 14-year-old girl, about 5 feet tall, 95 pounds, with long, curly brown hair. She offered an award for Regina's whereabouts. At this point, she was still hoping that she was at a friend's house and that the award would encourage someone to step forward and tell authorities where Regina was. So at this point, we have a missing persons case involving a juvenile, and this case gets forwarded on to Suzanne Jackson, who is a detective with the juvenile division.
Yeah, so she's basically a detective that commonly looks for like truancy cases, like people who haven't been at school and missing juveniles, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's really lucky that she gets the case because, as we're going to see, she does a really phenomenal job about tracking Regina down. So about 5 days after Regina's disappearance, Carolyn gets a phone call in response to the missing persons flyer, and I'm sure the reward, let's face it. So this clue from this caller points Carolyn and investigators to Ricky Lee Jones, but the caller also informs them that no one had heard or seen from Regina or Ricky for about 4 days, and that the last that they'd heard, Ricky and Regina had seen the flyers, the missing persons flyers, about Regina and that they had decided then to run away to Mexico. So police suspect that this was because that if Ricky was caught with Regina, he would have been charged with the contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Ricky was already on probation for theft at this point, so he would have gotten in really big trouble. And armed with this information, Suzanne Jackson issues a warrant for Ricky's arrest. She knows that for Ricky, since he was on probation, leaving the jurisdiction was a violation of his parole. She knew that this was going to be the best way to track down both Ricky and Regina. And the only reason why she does this is she knows that he's trying to flee with a minor. And so she's just trying to put all this information together in order to contact and find Regina. She also puts Regina and Ricky's descriptions into the National Crime Information Center, which lists victims and criminals nationwide. So they really try to track down Regina as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, she doesn't get a hit on this database, and she knows that her case will probably go cold until something comes up. So at this point, the pair were basically lost to authorities, and she thinks that the two, at this point, have probably fled to Mexico, and there's really not a way, if they have already crossed the border, there's not a way that she can locate them.
Yeah, because remember, this is pre-9/11. So back then, you could, as long as you were a U.S. citizen, you could go across the Mexico border and come back without a passport. And it was way easier. They're only like an hour or two away from the Mexico border.
So just as this case is getting cold, there are suddenly two calls made to Regina's family over the course of 2 days by an unknown male caller. The calls were placed to Regina's mother and her father. The first phone call was made March 16th to Regina's father, Jerry Walters. The caller stated, "I made some changes. I cut her hair." The caller told Regina's father that he had left her in a barn loft, but when her father asked if she was still alive, the caller hung up. The calls were made to both his work number and to his home number, which was unlisted. Both calls were very brief, and Jerry basically said he was not able to recognize the caller's voice. The same night as the calls to Jerry, Regina's mother is called as well. Suzanne Jackson didn't know about the calls to Jerry yet, but she had already advised Carolyn to record any incoming calls as she thought that they might be pertinent to the case because of the flyers that Carolyn had posted around the city. So this unknown man asked her to meet him at a convenience store the next morning at 6:30 a.m. He told Carolyn he had information on the whereabouts of Regina, but he only wanted to tell her in person. Carolyn gave this information to Suzanne Jackson, and the police arranged a supervised surveillance of this meetup. So police observed Carolyn as she waited at this convenience store for this unknown person. She waited over 2 hours, but this caller never showed up. Police received phone traces from the initial two phone calls to Regina's parents. The first, the one to Jerry Walters, Regina's father, was made from a gas station in Ennis, Texas. The second call that Jerry received and the call to Carolyn were made from Oklahoma City. Now, at this point, Pasadena police suspect that whatever the outcome of Regina's case, foul play would definitely be involved. So they begin actively tapping both Carolyn and Jerry's phones. A few weeks later, another call was made to Carolyn, and the unknown man, the same person who had been calling before, asked to meet her in person once again. The police are able to triangulate the call within minutes and find that the call was coming from blocks away, from a payphone near Carolyn's house.
Whoa.
But by the time the police got there, the caller was already gone. So how unsettling is that?
Yeah, he's toying with them. He's playing with them. And this is like some next level stuff that's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also see him physically moving kind of around the country. And we have him in Ennis, Texas, which is north. We have mm-hmm. him in Oklahoma City, which is even north again. And then we see him back in Pasadena, just blocks away from where Carolyn lives. And it's almost like, was he attempting maybe to meet with her some point? Or was he just...
I think he's just toying with him. You know, he's increasing the terror.
Months go by with no additional leads, and hopes for recovering Regina grow bleak. The person, this caller, never calls back again, and so they don't really have any other additional information to go on. Until 3 months later, on September 29th, 1990, A farmer was searching an old barn on his property near Interstate 70 in Bond County, Illinois. He was basically making sure there wasn't anything important inside this barn because he was set to burn the barn down. As he's searching the barn, he finds in the loft the body of a young girl. Illinois State Police investigate the scene and they find the victim has no clothes or no identifying information on the body. The forensic anthropologist Mark Jonesy is called in to examine the remains and makes several useful observations. So he sees that the body was a young female between 14 and 16 years old, weighing about 90 to 110 pounds. There was evidence that the hair on her head and pubic region had been cut very short. He also saw that the girl had been dead about a year. The victim had been strangled with a garrote made from baling wire and a length of wood. Both of these items had been found inside the barn. So these were not weapons that had been brought with the killer into the barn. He had literally fashioned weapons from his natural surroundings in this kill site. The wire had been twisted tightly 16 times around the victim's neck. So tightly and so many times that it was basically overkill. Her neck had almost been severed from this wire being tied around her neck. There's basically no other additional information that they could glean from the site. The only thing that they were able to find were strands of cotton, likely from a white towel, which were discovered close to the body.
Now remember the towel that was found at Robert Ben Rhodes' apartment. It was saturated with blood. And then also, several of his victims talked about the placement of a white towel during their torture and their rape.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this being pretty much some of the only forensic evidence they have, they knew that these white fibers were kind of important, if not maybe something that they could use to actively track down the killer. Illinois State Police searched the National Crime Database for this Jane Doe, and the results are complete insanity. At the time, there were 950 missing women and young girls nationally within the age group of this body, within the height and weight stats, and who had been missing for about a year. Almost 1,000 young girls and women.
Yeah, it's a ton of victims. It's a needle in a haystack.
It's absolutely terrifying. So teletypes were then sent to detectives working on all of these cases from these missing persons. One of the teletypes reaches our friend Suzanne Jackson back in Pasadena, Texas on October 16th. Suzanne Jackson calls the sheriff's office in Bond County, Illinois, and speaks to the secretary. Now, the secretary has been inundated with all of these calls about this missing body, and honestly, she kind of blows her off a little. She basically tells Suzanne, "We've had so many callers. I really can't talk to you or give you additional information right now, but you know, we'll have somebody call you back later with more information." As she's hanging up the phone, Suzanne Jackson blurts out the question of whether or not the victim was found in a barn. Because Suzanne Jackson is remembering the phone calls that this mysterious caller had made to Regina's parents, mentioning about leaving her in a barn. The secretary immediately realizes that Suzanne might be onto something, and she patches Suzanne Jackson through to the investigators. Suzanne tells them about the missing girl and the phone calls to Regina's family. Suzanne and Regina's family are able to supply dental x-rays that were sent to Bond County Sheriff's Office, and the results confirmed that it was, in fact, Regina Walters who was found in the barn in Illinois.
Oh my goodness. Thank God for Suzanne Jackson to have the wherewithal to go through these teletypes that come in.
And it's such a long shot too.
Yeah, it is.
And like you said, a needle in a haystack. If you have almost 1,000 people who could potentially be this missing victim, it's stunning that they were able to find out who it was.
And if she hadn't have been doing her due diligence as her juvenile detection position of just maybe going through these everyday teletypes, looking for something on her cases, this would not have been discovered. And having the wherewithal to mention the fact that was she found in a barn.
Exactly.
It's amazing. So now let's jump over to the FBI side of things. So at this point, we have two separate FBI agents working on seemingly two separate cases. Agent Bob Lee is covering Nicole Tuttle and Katie Ford's abduction cases, as well as the search and seizure of Robert Ben Rhodes' Houston apartment. and Agent Mark Young is tasked with trying to track down Regina Walters' killer. Now, Agent Mark Young and the FBI entered Regina's case in early 1991 because she was kidnapped from the Houston area, but her remains were found in Illinois. Therefore, it was a capital offense that crossed state lines. Now, Young studied the crime scene photos from the barn in Illinois, and he noted that Regina's hair was short and that the forensic report told Young something very crucial. Her pubic hair had been shaved prior to death. Young realized that Regina's killer may have been the one to do this to her prior to death, and knew it may be an important signature of this killer. So at this point, Illinois investigators knew that Regina had last been seen with Ricky Lee Jones, who was also missing, by the way. Because of this, they believed Ricky Lee Jones to be their best suspect. But based on his profiling experience, and on the evidence that he had seen from the crime scene, Young knew that this killer was an older man, he was more experienced.
Yeah, so the scene was completely organized, this body was stripped down and left out in the open, which is something that a young, inexperienced killer was less likely to do. Young also suspected that the killer was a traveler. We have maybe a truck driver, a traveling salesman, or a businessman who is traveling often. And because we know that she was kidnapped from Houston and we know that she was found in Illinois. So we know that this girl was taken quite a bit distance-wise across the country.
Yeah. This is something that Young and the Illinois authorities kind of go back and forth on. They're both kind of arguing their two different theories. Illinois State Police are kind of getting upset at the FBI because they're requesting a national manhunt for Ricky Lee Jones. They've searched for Ricky a little bit, and they've come up with nothing. Meanwhile, Agent Young suspected Ricky was already dead and had been killed by the same person who killed Regina. But regardless of Young's profiling, Ricky was charged in absentia for the murder of Regina Walters in Bond County, Illinois.
So little did authorities know that Ricky Lee Jones' body was actually found on March 3rd, 1991 in Lamar County, Mississippi. However, his body was not identified until July 2008. So that's why if you look at certain articles or you watch certain documentaries, many of them claim that Jones's body has never been found. That's actually not true. It's just it was discovered pretty early on. It just wasn't actually identified until 2008. So that was only 10 years ago. After Jones's body was identified, it was thought that the killer had almost immediately killed Ricky and dumped his body in Mississippi and obviously kept Regina for a longer period of time. And this all basically later confirmed Young's early suspicions.
Right. And at this point, Young's case, it pretty much runs cold. It's not until later in October of 1991, almost a year after Regina's body was found in Illinois, Mark Young is discussing Regina's case with some colleagues at the Houston FBI office. He mentions the fact that she was found with shaved pubic hair and really shortly cut hair. Bob Lee happens to be in the same place. He overhears this information, and it sounds familiar to him. Lee starts remembering his case on Nicole Tuttle and Katie Ford, who had also been kidnapped and tortured, and Nicole had her hair cut short. Her pubic hair was shaved by her perpetrator. He asks Young to look at his files on Nicole Tuttle and Katie Ford, and specifically, he wanted Young to see the photos recovered from Robert Ben Rhodes' apartment. These photos had always haunted Bob Lee. He was curious if Mark Young would recognize any of the young women as Regina, his victim.
So remember, one section of the series of photos is on a young teenager. She had very shortly, closely cropped hair. In the pictures, this girl wore a black dress. She had on black high-heeled shoes and a dog collar. Her fingernails had also been freshly painted red, and in this particular photo, she looks terrified. Now, this photo is a very famous picture that has made its round on the internet, and it's probably something that you, as I'm describing it, you know what I'm talking about. We will not be posting this photo ourselves in respect for the victim, especially the fact that this victim is a young child. But be warned that it's out there. It's going to pop up on any search you do on this case. So I want to give you that warning because personally, I can look at any grisly, gory, horrible crime scene photo and not be too disturbed about it, but there's something about seeing the terror in this young girl's eyes that is especially horrible. And I just want to tell you guys, if you look at this photo, remember this is a 14-year-old girl who is seconds away from her death. Now, to also be clear, there are many pictures of this girl taken by Robert Bryn Rhodes, but only a few of them have been released to the public. The more terrible ones of her rape and torture have thankfully never been made public, but they also did exist. They were found within Robert Bryn Rhodes' apartment.
Yeah, definitely. These are one of those things that we see them from time to time when they pop up, and it always makes us feel bad because we're just like, why are these making the rounds again?
It's one of the worst pictures I've ever seen, to be honest. It's one of those pictures I'm like, I kind of wish I've never seen it before, because it is haunting. And I think that's exactly why investigators felt the way that they did upon seeing them, is because they knew what they were looking at. They knew that this was a girl who was seconds away from being murdered.
And you're not,
they just didn't know who she was.
You're not alone in that. I see a lot of people who say the exact same thing on message boards. Yeah. So back to the case, Young believes that the girl in this particular set of photos that we were just talking about looks similar to one of the last known photos of Regina. In his photo, however, Regina had long hair and was sitting happily in a friend's car. He could not conclusively say that it was the same girl because, you know, there had been modifications. Sadly, at this point, though, Young has to resort to taking one of the photos of the girl in the barn and showing it to Regina's father. Upon seeing it, he confirmed that it was Regina. She also had three birthmarks on her neck, which are visible in the photo, and this was further evidence that it was the same girl and that Robert Bryn Rhodes was in fact the killer.
So, a little aside about Robert Bryn Rhodes and how absolutely messed up he was. We've talked a lot already about Rhodes and this deal that he would do, which would be cutting the hair of his victims very short and shaving his victims' pubic hair. We know that this was his signature. It's suggested by some psychologists that he shaved the woman's pubic hair in order to make them appear more prepubescent. It's also suggested that the cutting of the hair on their head, combined with the shaving of the pubic hair, was Rhodes somehow projecting his younger self onto his victims and essentially reenacting the abuse of his father towards him. So I have a couple things to say about this. Now, I mean, you guys know I'm not a psychologist. I will be very clear about that. But personally, I think it makes more sense that the cutting of the hair of the head was done to further humiliate and degrade his victims. After all, we know that long hair is traditionally considered an especially female trait. And by literally butchering that sign of femaleness, I think that he felt that that added to his sense of total control and authority over his victims, basically butchering their very identity as women. So that's my take on it. As far as the whole prepubescent thing and the shaving of the pubic hair, I'd also like to point out, though, that he very clearly dressed Regina as a woman. In this photo that we're talking about, she's dressed like a 30-year-old businesswoman, essentially. She's wearing, you know, a very sort of business structured dress with high heels. He's painted her nails. He's not making her look young. He's making her look older, if anything. So to me, I think it makes more sense that the shaving of the pubic hair, that was just a weird fetish of his. And it's once again just something that allowed him to force his control over these women's bodies.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen places where they described the way he dressed her and the way that she looked as sexual and lustful. But I mean, the outfit that she's wearing is very covered up. It's very formal.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think it's just, it was his way. It was something about that that really turned him on. And I think more than anything else, it was just him. It was an outfit he chose that he made them wear, that he,
it's a part of his psychosis.
Their bodies in. I mean, it's all related to his control and domination over these women.
Yeah, it's part of his psychosis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that agents knew that Rhodes and Regina Walters were linked, Bob Lee and Mark Young began working on the case together.
Yay!
Our two of our biggest heroes are coming together. They're joining forces like the Avengers to try and wrap their mind around this freaking case. Around this point, they quickly realized that Regina and Ricky went missing the exact same day that Nicole Tuttle escaped. We talked about this at the top, but I'm going to reiterate this. This means that Robert Bryn Rhodes was torturing Nicole, she escapes, and then he's detained and questioned about Nicole's attacks. And then he drove literally 15 miles down the road and picked up Regina and Ricky.
Yeah. And then almost immediately, we know this later, almost immediately dispatched Ricky and kept Regina for roughly 2 weeks.
Yeah. So this goes back into he's getting really cocky at this stage of his serial killing career. You know, he's taken huge risks again. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before, but this seems crazy to me. You would think that somebody would go, okay, I was questioned by the police. I got real close to being caught. Maybe I should play it safe. Maybe I should move a state over, do my serial killing there, and move on. But no, not Robert Ben Rhodes. He's going to find the next couple on the road and pick them up.
So authorities believe that Robert Ben Rhodes kept Regina for about 2 weeks before he killed her. This was determined by a few different factors. First of all, it was his known locations from where he picked up Regina in Pasadena and from where her body was later dumped in Illinois. It was also the total amount of regrowth of her hair as seen in the pictures that he took and in the bruising seen in her pictures and on her body.
Right. And at this point, Lee and Young, they find out this information and they start going into high gear.
Yeah, but basically they start backtracking from what they already know. Let's get all this information together. We know that these cases are linked. We know Rhodes is behind everything. What more can we find out about him?
Exactly. So they immediately call Arizona, where Rhodes had been sentenced for 6 years for kidnapping Katie Ford. And they find out two very troubling things. So first off, Robert Ben Rhodes is about to begin a work furlough, where he would be released for a probationary full-time work program. This program could allow Robert Ben Rhodes to be outside of prison for up to 12 hours a day and 6 days a week.
Yeah, and it's absolutely insane because he was sentenced for the kidnapping, torture, and rape of a woman. He was only sentenced to 6 years, and he was going to be getting off in what, two?
Two and a half, I believe. Something like that.
Something like that. Some insane amount of time. And before he was even released, he would be out there working and living amongst us.
Yeah.
Everyday,
fun fact, people. Some of these work probationary programs in Arizona, you can go to work at a school.
Yeah.
So
that's where he needs to be for sure.
So second, the two agents learn that the evidence from Robert Ben Rhodes' truck is set to be destroyed. Well, luckily, they're able to stop Robert Ben Rhodes' probationary work program by showing that they are currently investigating him on murder for additional women. They were also able to save the evidence from being destroyed and send agents to go and pick it up. One of the items that they discover amongst the evidence collected from Robert Ben Rhodes' truck is a small blue notebook that had been owned by Regina Walters. Inside were unlisted phone numbers for Regina's father, mother, and grandmother. This explains the calls to Regina's family because many of the numbers were unlisted, as we mentioned before. This is, in fact, how Robert Ben Rhodes knew them.
Yeah, and just as a little aside, I do want to mention how heartbreaking it is to actually see this notebook because inside you can see Regina's handwriting and it's such like childlike handwriting. I think it really just reiterates and reinforces the idea that this was a little girl. I mean, it's like child's scrawling handwriting, like daddy's phone number, mommy's. I mean, it's just, it's really sad. So not only is the notebook really upsetting because we see Regina's handwriting, we get to know her a little bit more, but within this notebook is a picture that was clearly not drawn by Regina. This picture reads, "Ricky is a dead man" in this bloody kind of weird scrawl, and there are crudely drawn images of a dripping bloody knife and a gun. This was done in handwriting that was very different from Regina's, and there were also other notes written in the same handwriting that included strange words such as water tank, fun and hide, and just all of these sort of bizarre things. So the investigators took this picture and all of these weird scrawls to Deborah Davis. If you remember from part one of our series, Deborah Davis was Robert Ben Rhodes's third wife. So they took these pictures and these handwriting samples to her, and she did confirm that the handwriting samples were in fact her husband's. So basically Robert Ben Rhodes was drawing in this notebook, and we can imagine possibly even using this as a kind of a way to torture Regina, especially this drawing that says Ricky is a dead man and having this bloody gun and this knife, maybe the very tools that he used to kill Ricky. And so it's obviously extremely upsetting. And we do have a picture of this drawing that we will post up to our social media account so you can see it.
So besides the notebook, they also find additional pictures of Regina in the evidence that was set to be destroyed from Robert Ben Rhodes's original case where they searched his truck. Lee and Young were also able to track down the truck itself from the case, which since then it had been returned to the trucking company after Robert Ben Rhodes's arrest, and it was thoroughly cleaned, and now it was back in use with a different driver.
Which is really creepy to think that you're just like this random truck driver dude doing your job.
Yeah.
And all of this horrific stuff has happened in the cab that you sleep in.
Yeah, because they didn't know.
No, of course not.
But they know now.
Yeah.
So they thought it was a long shot, but they decided to do another full search of the truck. Thankfully, they did take this chance because they were able to identify one partial print that actually belonged to Regina Walters in the sleeping compartment of the cab.
Which is crazy because we're talking about something that's happened, you know, months and months, I think even a couple of years later after Regina was even in that cab, and they were able to identify this additional information or this additional evidence that tied Rhodes to Regina Walker.
Yeah. And in fact, there's one of the documentaries, they have a photo of the agent pulling the print off of the leather wall of the cab. And it's like, oof, there it is. We know that truckers have to keep specific records of their locations, like where they stop for rest stops and fuel and et cetera. But this also comes into play in building the case against Robert Ben Rhodes. So his trip logs actually determined that he had been along Interstate 70 in Bond County, where Regina's body had been found. And in February of March 1990, he was right along that same stretch of highway. And authorities believe that this was, in fact, the time that she was murdered. So finally, in September of 1992, these agents are getting all this information. They're everything we talked about. They're pulling it all together in one case file. They're right up against the time clock, you know, because Robert Ben Rhodes is going to get out on probation. In September of 1992, they present their case and their evidence against Robert Ben Rhodes to him and his attorneys. Rhodes takes a look, and he immediately knows that they have sufficient evidence against him. So he agrees to a plea deal where he would receive life in prison without the possibility of parole. He began serving this sentence in Menard Correctional Center in Southern Illinois.
So while we'd love to say that that's the beginning and ending of Robert Ben Rhodes' story, unfortunately, it is not. In January 1990, about a month before Regina's death, Candace Walsh, 24, and husband Scott Ziskowski, I've seen him reported as either 25 or 28, these two were newlyweds, they were originally from Seattle, and they were hitchhiking across the country to Georgia. So they're literally going across the country, as far across the country as you can from Seattle to somewhere in Georgia. And they were going to preach the gospel. They were very deeply religious, and this was something that they were wanting to do to begin their new life together. They were in El Paso, Texas, when they got a ride from Robert Ben Rhodes. It's believed that Robert Ben Rhodes almost immediately killed Ziskowski, just like he did Ricky Lee Jones, and dumped his body in Ozona, Texas, which is about 320 miles east of El Paso. His body was discovered in 1990, but once again, he wasn't identified until 1992. So 2 years after his body was found, he was actually finally identified. Utah officials report that Robert Ben Rhodes held Walsh captive for about a week before shooting her multiple times in the head and dumping her body. Walsh's body was found months later by hunters in Millard County, Utah, which is about 22 miles south of Fillmore. Her body was very badly decomposed, and she went unidentified for 13 years. Even with a poor state of her body, it was clear that she had been sexually tortured, and her body had been posed after death. She was finally identified in 2003 via dental comparisons, and DNA helped point to Robert Ben Rhodes as her killer. A little interesting tidbit, they only discovered the DNA match via an act of good fortune, as Rhodes had apparently, quote, fallen through a crack in the system, according to the Utah Assistant State's Attorney. After identifying Walsh's body and realizing that she fit the victim profile and that the MO seemed to fit Rhodes, Utah officials made the request for DNA testing. Now, under normal conditions, Rhodes' DNA would not have been tested or put into a database until his release from prison, and because he'd been convicted of a life sentence with Regina Walters' murder, that wasn't going to happen. So basically, his DNA would never have been put into this database because he was never going to be released.
Wow.
And back in 1992, when he was first arrested for the assault on Katie Ford, obviously DNA testing wasn't being done at that time. So he fit into this perfect area where he could have easily gotten away with these two additional murders if it wasn't for the authorities in Utah doing their due diligence and in seeing this case in the end and making the request to test Rhodes' DNA against Walsh's body.
Right. It's just another example of how lucky we are in these investigations that these people went all the way.
Absolutely. So Robert Burns was already serving a life sentence in Illinois for Regina's murder. But in 2005, he was extradited to Utah to stand trial for the murders of Walsh and Ziskowski, where prosecutors were going to go for the death penalty. In Utah, Robert Rhodes could have only been charged for Walsh's murder, since that's where her body was found. Texas, however, thank you, hallelujah, Texas. Texas could prosecute Robert Rhodes for both Walsh and Ziskowski's murders in one trial. This is because Ziskowski was murdered in Texas, and Walsh's story had also began in Texas because that's where she had been originally kidnapped. So in 2006, the families of the victims agreed to have Utah drop its case against Robert Rhodes and instead have him tried for two counts of murder in Texas, where again, Texas, you know how we like to do it, would seek the death penalty. This made sense at the time because the witnesses were all the same. And by doing this, it really allowed the families to only have to suffer through one trial instead of multiple trials. And as prosecutor Brent Berkley put it, this was, quote, in the best case of the victims and would bring swifter justice. This is something that made a lot of sense.
Yeah. When we were originally researching this, we didn't understand, like, why they moved the case.
No, because a lot of articles just say, oh, well, the victims wished to drop the case in Utah. And we were like, well, why? Why would they want to do that? But when you actually break it down, it makes a lot of sense, I think. Once again, though, once he gets to Texas and once they're working on this trial, Rhodes agreed to yet another plea deal, this time again for life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, I don't know. I guess it's because it was the age of the case, the fact that he was already serving a life sentence. But it's frustrating because it also means because he had the plea deal and there wasn't an actual trial that was set forth, we, as in the public, we don't know the full details about what happened to Ziskowski and Walsh. That's why, if you're wondering, like, wow, this section of the case is going by very quickly, it's because there just really isn't that many details. I mean, for example, what was the DNA that they tested that connected Rhodes to Walsh? I mean, where would they find that? You know, none of that information is out there. At least I can't find it. It's not publicly available. And we don't know their stories. And I think that's really sad. You know, the case really wasn't that covered in the media as well. And I think that a lot of that is, again, because it's a dude who's already serving a life sentence and he's just getting another life sentence on top of that. And so we just really have these bare bone details. So I would like to point out, though, Robert Rhodes has never been prosecuted for Ricky Lee Jones's murder, even though it's certainly obvious that Ricky Lee Jones was another one of Robert Rhodes's victims. So, you know, we do have him prosecuted for four murders. He is serving two life sentences without the possibility of parole. That's something I think to be happy for.
Yeah, but I also feel like the lack of public eye that's been able to be shined on this case through the media not covering it and the lack of the trial really keeps this case hidden from a lot of true crime fans as well, because there's just not a lot of press about it. And it also maybe keeps some of the interest out of looking into some of his other victims, which I think we're going to get into.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and not only that, it's just because of the fact that he's just so silent, he will never talk. Yeah. And that's something also we'll bring up here. But I mean, there's a lot of reasons, I think, why this case has never really been brought to the public eye that well. Since we have Regina Walters and we have Ziskowski and Walsh, More bodies have been found in the area where Rhodes frequented, and the FBI is continuing their work into identifying other victims of the truck stop killer. Authorities think that by 1990, so this is about the time where he first gets arrested for the attack on Katie Ford, when he was finally apprehended, they think by this time he was kidnapping and killing around 3 women a month. Oof. So over the years as a trucker, he had made regular trips to over 20 states. So we have multiple jurisdictions and agencies who we obviously know it's difficult for these agencies to cooperate together and to get the resources together to connect cases that are done in geographical, sure, distant areas.
We just outlined it in Regina's case. It's a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, absolutely. And we went over in part one how he told one of his victims how he'd been doing this, i.e. kidnapping, torturing, and killing women, for over 15 years. And authorities really have no reason to doubt this. So we're talking about something where he had probably been working for 10 to 15 years at his height, perhaps kidnapping and killing 3 women a month. So we're talking about really big numbers. And to me, it's clear that in 1990 or so, when he was finally caught, I think it's very clear that he had been killing for some time. He was ramping up his attacks. He was attacking multiple people in a very short amount of time. And as we already talked about, even attacking Nicole Tuttle and Regina and Ricky the very same day. And I think we can see that he was getting sloppy. So other killers like Ted Bundy have admitted that as a serial killer sort of ages and they continue killing, they grow almost comfortable with their crimes and they start making little mistakes. So, for example, Robert Morode's parking his truck on an on-ramp while attacking Katie Ford. That's a sloppy mistake. Mm-hmm. So I think we see him getting comfortable. He's getting sloppy. We also know that he had huge amounts of time on the road by himself. At one point, his third wife, Deborah, stated that he had been on the road for 3 months on one trip. So he certainly had this opportunity to kill as many women as he wanted to with really no recourse, without anybody knowing that he was doing this.
Yeah. Even time to plan and plot before he picked up his victims, you know, and then once he has them, he's got plenty of time to do whatever he wants with them, drop them off and dump their body wherever he decides to.
Sure. And with the 4 victims that we know of, we can see he also does not shy away from attacking couples, which I would argue is kind of, it's a risky move. It's very dangerous. And it's often seen late in a serial killer's career as they continue to ramp up their crimes. If you know anything about Richard Ramirez or the original Night Stalker, you know, killing couples, killing multiple people together, or, you know, attacking and dispatching the male while then, you know, attacking and torturing the woman. That's something that a lot of serial killers do sort of late in their careers, at something that gets them excited. They're amping up the danger level. And so I think that all of these reasons really do suggest that this is a man who, these were not his first victims. These were not, this is not a man who's only killed 4 people. I think we can say for sure that he killed many, many more beyond that. So what makes a sexual sadist serial killer? I think that's a really good question to ask, because obviously, although there aren't that many of them, they're out there. And I think we have to question who they are, how to identify them, and how even to prevent them from occurring. So thankfully, the FBI has compiled details about the lives of sexual sadists like Robert Monroe's based on 30 individuals that they have studied and interviewed. Out of these 30, almost all were Caucasian males. Many had jobs where they had contact with the public or were in the service industry. They most commonly collected pornography, usually of a very violent nature. They also collected things like guns, bondage paraphernalia, and detective magazines, weirdly enough, which I think is very odd. 75% of these men had eventually murdered, and almost half were married at the time of their crimes, and their wives were often victims of their abuse as well. Hmm. So just a few little details. I mean, there's not a lot there maybe, but I think there's a lot of interesting information there. Hey, you meet a Caucasian male who likes bondage and detective magazines, you stay away.
Yeah.
You run.
It definitely sounds like Robert Ben Rhodes.
Yeah,
he fits exactly into this category completely.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Robert Ben Rhodes was all of those things.
Yeah.
So.
So kind of going along with that study, there is a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel that we can look forward to in cases like Robert Ben Rhodes. So in 2004, the FBI begins doing some preliminary research into highway killings that are happening across the nation. And by 2009, the FBI Highway Serial Killing Initiative actually goes public and gets announced. The Highway Serial Killing Initiative, their purpose is to raise awareness among law enforcement agencies and the general public about highway killers and their victims. So through some of the work done by VICAP analysts, they discovered more than 500 murder victims in their database associated with the U.S. highway system, along with 200 potential suspects. I can tell you that now we know that at least 27 of these suspects have been apprehended and put behind bars for being involved with these murders. So that's some good news. So we should also point out here that Texas leads the nation in unsolved serial highway murders. However, the submission into the Highway Serial Killing Initiative is voluntary. So Texas might be better at reporting these types of cases, or it might just be that they have a lot of murder. According to their press release, the goals of the FBI Highway Serial Killing Initiative includes the following. So it's sponsoring free regional training sessions for law enforcement agencies that are located near major interstates and highways, which I think is very important. Like they need this kind of regional training more than anybody else, obviously. And then educating victim advocacy groups with special consideration to groups that represent women and children. And finally, using the skills of the behavioral analysis experts at the National Center for Analysis of Violent Crime. These experts can provide investigation, interview, and prosecution strategies, as well as ways to link cases based on behavioral characteristics. So all of that is good, and it has helped the FBI to kind of get a handle on these serial killers and highway murders and these bodies that have popped up all over the country. So not only is the FBI created a specific task force for this issue, but truckers themselves have actually stepped forward and they've created their own group to deal with the problem of human trafficking. It's called Truckers Against Trafficking, and it's a really cool group. So in 2011, the group Truckers Against Trafficking is formed. Its mission statement, according to its website, is to educate, equip, empower, and mobilize members of the trucking and travel plaza industry to combat human trafficking. And so their main goal is to get all of their information out to as many truckers as possible. And how they do that is they basically produce these little wallet-sized cards that they hand out, as well as hosting online courses that are accessible to truckers about how to fight against human trafficking. And it actually works pretty good. They also partner with law enforcement and government agencies to help investigate human trafficking cases. So what you might get is like a trucker at one of these layover stations where he's parked somewhere and he sees something going on where he thinks someone might be in danger. He can pull out that card, he can call a hotline and report what's going on. It just basically gets a way to get the authorities and everybody on the same page to what's going on quicker and faster and stop this whole thing from happening in the first place. Truckers Against Trafficking, by the numbers, we've got a little thing from their website. They've had 1,900 calls made to the national hotline by truckers alone. So they've identified 545 likely human trafficking cases. These involved about 1,000 trafficking victims, with about 315 of which were minors. They've had over 1 million of these little wallet cards distributed. They have like 474,000 people that are Truckers Against Trafficking trained.
Yeah, it sounds like a really good organization. It's really cool to see that people have taken this concept seriously about not truckers, but also other people who are wandering around the country doing really seedy stuff and very violent stuff as well. And this is a really cool organization where you're actually taking it to the streets and you're engaging the people themselves, truckers themselves, in stopping this kind of behavior. And it sounds like they're doing a really great job. And it's great that they're taking something like this seriously, because we know very small number of truckers out there are bad and are doing things like Robert Ben Rhodes. And truckers, it's one of the most important industries that we don't ever think about within the United States. I mean, I know one of the documentaries we were looking at said something like, look around your house and realize every single item in your house has come to you at some point via truck.
Yeah.
Every single item. And so it's something that our entire economy is built around trucking. And so We want to make things as safe for people on the highways as possible. This is just, you know, sex workers or hitchhikers or whoever, but also for truckers themselves. Yeah. So it sounds like a really great thing that they're doing. So, I mean, that pretty much wraps up our case on Robert Ben Rhodes. He is a terrible human being. He is now rotting in prison. He is 70-something years old.
He is 72.
So yeah, he is 72 years old. He is rotting in prison and he will spend the rest of his life in prison. However many years that is. I know that one of the books I was reading that was published in 1998 and it said that he had been diagnosed with colon cancer. And this was back in 1998. So that would mean that he's been living with colon cancer for about 20 years. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's something that has happened apparently. But I think it's very fitting for a huge asshole like Robert Ben Rhodes, his asshole is literally eating him alive.
Yeah, that's true. So let's give out some awards. How about we do that?
An awards ceremony, huh?
An awards ceremony. So I would like to propose that we give out the 4 Texas True Crime Medals of Honor of this episode.
Okay.
Yeah. So who's first on your list?
Well, first on the list that you've provided me is Officer Mike Miller of the Arizona Highway Patrol. So this is the guy who actually led to Robert Ben Rhodes' arrest when he found Katie Ford in the back of his truck and was able to safely confiscate the man himself and bring him into justice.
He almost let Robert Ben Rhodes kill them both and continued down the road. But luckily, he didn't.
He didn't.
He went back and checked on him.
Yeah. Second up would be FBI agent Bob Lee.
Also from episode 1 appearance.
Yes. And working alongside agent Mark Young, these two guys did a really phenomenal job of connecting all these cases, gathering all of this evidence, and bringing Robert Ben Rhodes to justice and, you know, getting Regina Walters' case solidified. I mean, it's something that they could have ignored.
Yeah, they brought it all together and actually got us to a conclusion.
Yep.
And then finally, let's not forget Pasadena, Texas juvenile detective Suzanne Jackson, who was freaking Suzanne on the spot. And I'd also like to point out that when Bob Lee and Mark Young made their special task force that started figuring out what was going on with this Regina Walters case, they brought Suzanne in and she worked closely with them.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and she's gone on to have a great career, and she's super cool. I love Suzanne Jackson. That's all I have to say about her.
Yeah, so thank God for those 4 people who did a really bang-up job. And then, of course, I'm sure there were a lot of other people along the way who did really great work in catching this guy. And, you know, hopefully we'll continue maybe getting other investigations done and getting other people who are other victims that are out there who may or may not have been identified, because we know that they're out there. Hey, Shay.
Hey, Aaron.
We've been doing a lot of talking about a real horrible human garbage person. So do you want to talk about some good news for a second?
I do. And I feel like this case has put a hole in our hearts and it needs to be filled
with good
news. It's
really just been the most depressing few weeks of our lives.
I hope it turns out into a good episode because it's so awful.
Oh my gosh, you guys, it's been really hard. But let's talk about some good news.
Okay, good news.
So our good news this week comes from the Billy Earl Dade Middle School in Dallas. So they decided to host their first event called Breakfast with Dads. And this was an event where dads would get together, meet with the kids, hang out with their kids for the morning. They'd eat together and they'd do some kind of like dad and son related activities. Now, approximately 90% of the 900 students at the school came from low-income families. And after about 150 male students signed up for the event, they realized that there was going to be maybe an issue with some of these students either not having dads or not having dads who could appear, you know, maybe they couldn't take off work or something like that.
Sure.
So they go to Twitter.
Hey.
You know, a lot of our stories involve going to Twitter, go to Facebook and making these.
That's how you got to get the message out.
That's right. So they go to Twitter. And they put out a tweet that just says, hey, we need some volunteers. We need some dads who want to come and volunteer and be with these kids, help them be successful, and kind of volunteer for this, to be mentors for this little bit of a program. They asked for 50 volunteers on the day of the event. And guess how many men showed up?
30.
Over 600 men
Whoa.
Showed up to this event. There were so many dads.
That's too many dads.
It was too many dads. So many dads showed up that they had to actually move it from the cafeteria of the school to the gymnasium of the school. There's a lot of these really fantastic pictures of, like, there's men and there's just, like, they're just surrounded by all of these kids that they're kind of mentoring. And they're all, like, it really seems like they're having a good time. And they did things, like, they all ate together and then the men would, like, show them how to tie a necktie and that kind of stuff. Okay. Really just, like, mentoring type things. Yeah, so it seemed like a really good event. So, and I think, you know, our society, I think, is caught up with the idea that obviously mothers are very important to the life of a child, but I think fathers are equally important. Sure. And I think we're now at a point now where I think a lot of men, you know, realize that and just see that so many dads step up to the plate and kind of be, you know, mentors or kind of like foster dads for the day. I think it's such a cool thing to see. And it seemed just like such a nice event and good for everybody who was involved in that. It seems pretty nice.
Yeah, that is definitely good news. So now that we've had our palate cleansed, let's move on to some more good news, but it's like selfish good news. It's just for us, really. And it is our burden that we carry for every promise that we've made for people that give iTunes reviews. It's also very important. So we're going to do some iTunes shout outs. And thank you, everybody who goes to iTunes and gives us 5-star reviews. It's very important. Do you want to go first?
Sure. All right. Ebola Monger says, absolutely fantastic podcast, well-researched and great quality. Keep it coming. And full disclosure, we recognize that username. That's our very good friend, Kelly. So thank you, Kelly. Oh,
thank you, Kelly. Yeah, next up, Texas Does It Right. This is by Mr. B 4081. I'm really enjoying the new Texas-centric podcast. The hosts are very engaging and personable, and they have done a good job choosing interesting cases that I didn't know about. We keep hearing that, and I'm glad people are liking the cases we're choosing.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you want to recommend anything, just send us a message.
Yeah, we've got
you know how to contact us.
That's right.
Ambi K says, I was hesitant. I'm super picky about voices and mannerisms and whatnot, so I waited a while to hop on the bandwagon. I've seen this recommended quite a bit on Facebook, and I'm sure glad I finally gave in. So good. Cannot wait for more. Oh, thank you, Ambi.
Yes, thank you, Ambi. And finally, love! Exclamation 5-star review from It's like a bunch. It's just like they typed in a bunch of stuff. Anyways, they said, I love, love, love. Please send more episodes ASAP. I am a cat person, so I have to let that slide, but holy moly. Love the research. Love the little bit of levity you both bring. Love listening and can't wait for more. Cheers from Texas. So I guess they're referring to our dog talk?
Yeah.
Well, there might be more dog talk in the future. So watch out, cat people. We still like cat people. They're cool.
All right, guys, so remember, if you also want to shout on the show, just go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. You can also follow us on our social media accounts for extra information about each case on Twitter at ACNC Podcast or on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle, or you can send us an email at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. send us some information about what you'd like to hear on the podcast or any feedback at all. We would love it.
Yeah, and make sure you stay tuned right after this because we have a word from our friends over at Occulte Veritatis Podcast.
Yes. So we will see you hopefully in a few days as long as my immune system doesn't get completely overrun. And we will have an upcoming episode for you guys as soon as possible.
All right. Until then, adios.
Bye.
Hello, I'm Oud Gallifrey.
I'm Sage Murray.
And I'm Leon Felger.
And we are the Occulte Veritatis Podcast. We talk about anything that intrigues, horrifies, or interests us, including true crime.
Serial killers.
Military conspiracies.
And other mysteries and horrors of reality. So get cozy with your favorite alcoholic beverage.
Smoke a joint or two.
Only if it's legally purchased medicinal marijuana, of course. And tune in. We would love to have you.
We would.
You can find all of our links, all of the ways you can subscribe, and the rest of our bullshit at www.ovpod.ca. We hope you listen in soon.